Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gilbert Gottfried says he's loved old Hollywood since he was a kid, but when he launched a podcast featuring interviews with people like Robert Osborne, Barbara Feldon, Weird Al Yankovic, and former Munster Butch Patrick, he was concerned that the typical podcast listener wouldn't care. Actually, Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast has become one of the most popular new shows on iTunes. Mr. Gottfried, who has appeared in the comedy documentary The Aristocrats, on the ABC reality series Celebrity Wife Swap, and as the parrot Iago in Disney's Aladdin, will be headlining the comedy show at Caroline's on Broadway on Thanksgiving weekend, and it is my great pleasure to welcome him back to our show today. Hi.
I kind of feel like none of the microphones up here are made for my voice.
What kind of microphone would be made for your voice?
Well, I don't know. It just seems like on this show, it's always like it's like that.
Oh, you want to be public radio?
Yes.
Laid back? Well, you have many voices. Can you do a public radio voice?
Hi. We're coming.
I'm not that slow. You said that you didn't understand podcasts. So what made you want to start one?
I still don't. It's just like I have a website, gilbertgottfried.com. Don't really understand the point of it. Have a Twitter account that just helps get me into trouble with things.
Yes, we know about that. Oh, we may even talk about a few of those tweets.
And my podcast, Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast on gilbertgottfried.com. Subscribe to it on iTunes and SideshowNetwork.tv. And if you were to say to me, how can you find it by yourself? I wouldn't know how to do it.
So you can't listen to your own shows?
Yeah, or I don't know that I'd want to listen to my own shows. I'd be cringing the whole way through.
Because of the missed opportunities? Because sometimes when I hear an interview that I've done, and I'll think of a follow-up question. Why didn't I think of that at the time?
Yes, I do that constantly whenever, particularly in interviews. The second I leave, I go, oh, man, why? I said that when I should have said that. Now, here, because this is public radio, I can be an intellectual. There's a saying in French, but I can't pronounce it in French, called the spirit of the staircase. Meaning when you're going down the stairs is when you're thinking of everything you should have said.
You have been a regular on the Howard Stern Show for years. Have you always wondered what it would be like to run your own show?
I never really gave it all that much thought. You know, it was like, it's funny. It's like, I've been the person being interviewed all the time. And I kind of was comfortable with that because then I could sit there and go, oh, this guy interviewing me is an idiot.
And thanks a lot. Yeah. You've been on the show three times.
But I knew it in the first 5 minutes. Now, but then when I'm on the other side of the desk, then I realize, oh, wait a second, I'm the idiot in this interview.
Well, there's another side to that.
Yeah.
When you're being interviewed, you know, you don't have to do any work. You're just answering questions somebody else is coming up with. But when you're doing the interviewing, you actually have to come up with questions.
Yes. And I realize how quickly I can run out of questions.
Well, your first interviewee was Dick Cavett. you were starting off with somebody who's famous as an interviewer. Were you hoping to pick up some tips?
Oh, yeah. He was a great one to have because he's one of those you click the microphone on and then he talks. Mm-hmm. You know, he's no trouble. He's filled with a million stories. And so he's one of those you don't have to. Another one like that was, well, Robert Osborne from Turner Classic.
And you did Joe Franklin, who was doing celebrity interviews before any of us were born.
Oh, my God. And allegedly discovered everybody.
Well, he claims, anyway.
Yeah. Like, he, Joe Franklin said on my podcast that, and one time I was on one of my shows, I had on James Dean and Al Pacino. And I started doing the math. And I thought,
I don't think that's impossible.
Yeah, yeah, I think, well, then Al Pacino was 10 when he was on your show.
So Joe is, he has a faulty memory these days. I mean, he's Mr. Nostalgia.
He builds himself up quite a bit.
In your interview with Butch Patrick, he was very open about his drug taking and drinking. Do people reach a point where they just don't care about protecting their image?
It's funny. Well, with Butch Patrick, who played Eddie on The Munsters.
A werewolf.
Yes. And I remember I was thinking, this is going to be one of those pathetic interviews with a pathetic, bitter old guy. And I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, he talks openly about his drug use and drinking through the years and has got a sense of humor about himself. And he was very upbeat and he was fun to listen to. But as far as people like not caring, it's interesting because I interviewed Marty Allen from Allen and Rossi, who followed the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he's like in his 90s. And, you know, when I talk to him off the air, he'll always have some new dirty joke to tell me.
You never tell dirty jokes, so that must be a big surprise.
Yes, I was quite shocked and offended. But he always has some new dirty joke to tell me, and it's always funny. And then when I was on the air with him, and I said, could you tell me one of those jokes you always tell me on the phone? And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about.
And he could have done it. It's a podcast. It's not like radio where I have to worry about the FCC.
Yeah, but it was a matter of him and also I had Larry Storch from F Troop and a few others who they're in their 90s, but they're still worried about protecting their brand.
On the other hand, Barbara Feldon talked about applying for a job as a stripper before she became famous.
Yeah, Agent
99. Did you know about that before she said
it? I had heard about that. Agent 99. And it was when you talk to her and you look at her, it's like you can't believe this is someone who would ever go.
Well, and she would have been the most beautifully voiced stripper ever.
It's so funny. I can't tell you how many guys, and she's like, she's, I guess, in her 80s now, you know, because Get Smart was early 60s. And guys were writing, you know, were emailing me and tweeting me, slobbering over how sexy Barbara Feldon sounds. And one guy said, my crush has been reignited.
Do you enjoy talking to comics, funny people, because you can compare notes? It's one thing to talk to Marty Allen, another to talk to Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, yes. Weird Al Yankovic and Bob Saget and Jeff Ross. That, yeah, you could compare notes and get very silly. And you don't care what you're talking about after a while. It gets, you know.
Well, isn't that what comics do when they're in the back room while they're waiting to go on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you said you spent 90% of your life in comedy clubs, so you must have had a lot of those conversations that were never recorded, but you, in retrospect, wish had been.
Oh, yes, yeah. So these are the closest I've come to that. And it's like, yeah, you could get very out. It could go two ways. You could either be depressed and serious, or you get totally outrageous and the total bad taste to the point that the internet would fall in love and say they want you dead.
People do that?
Oh,
my God. They're so angry with you because of some of the things you've said over the years?
Oh, my God. It's like the internet. Well, the internet makes me sentimental for old-time lynch mobs. Because they actually had to leave the house, get their hands dirty, and deal with other people. And now it's like modern-day lynch mobs are on Twitter, and they sit in their underwear at the computer and go, well, let's burn his house down.
Well, I was shocked by some of the responses after Joan Rivers died. Because I thought she was just brilliant. She actually came to your defense after you were fired as the Aflac duck for posting tweets about the Japanese earthquake and the tsunami. Do you think it's the job of comedians to make us laugh after something tragic happens?
Oh, absolutely. And
you were too soon on 9/11 for some people.
Oh, yeah. But see, that's something that always gets me. There's that old saying that tragedy plus time equals comedy. And to me, I feel like when I say something right around the time that it's fresh, like when it's there that day, then people will, like, they'll gasp and cover their mouth and laugh, and they'll be embarrassed about laughing because that makes them feel good about themselves. See, I laughed, but I know I'm not supposed to. And I feel like at least there, people are shocked. And so you're acknowledging that something bad happened. Nowadays, you could do jokes about the Titanic, and it's sort of like, well, time passed, so screw those people who died. And it's, I feel like it's hypocritical.
Hmm. When some people were rooting for Leonardo DiCaprio to drown, but that's a Entertainment Weekly said that out of the 101 comedians who appear on screen, no one is funnier or more disgusting than Gilbert Gottfried. Did you take that as a compliment?
That was one of those odd compliments where you go, yeah, I am disgusting.
And my guess is Gilbert Gottfried. Alan Thicke was a guest on your podcast. Was that before or after you swapped wives with him on Celebrity Wife Swap?
Oh, that was after. It was funny. I was on one of my many great triumphs in show business right after being kicked off Saturday Night Live in their worst season.
You say that was one of the worst experiences in your whole, a low point in your whole career.
Oh, yeah, one of them.
Well, why do you think that they used you so little?
I don't know. And I after a while, I didn't mind that they used me so little because it was... The show, it was kind of like, it was right after the original cast left. So it was like, back then, it would be like if in the middle of Beatlemania, you said, well, John, Paul, George, and Ringo are leaving. We've got these four other guys. and so that's what it was like. And people were attacking the show before it even aired. And I remember there was one part of the show, because I hated the writers hated me. And so in one sketch, it was a funeral. It took place at a funeral, and I was the body in the coffin.
So you didn't get to talk or anything?
Yeah, I didn't have much lines in that one.
Well, let's get back to Alan Thicke.
Oh, so.
Yeah, you had said that you would never do reality TV, and then here you are on Celebrity Wife Swap. And I heard that you took Alan Thicke's very glamorous wife, Tanya Kalau, to a 99-cent store.
Yeah, took her to a 99-cent store. And I took her to the kitchen of the Friars Club in New York because quite often when I would be at the Friars Club for something, I would sneak downstairs in the kitchen where you could just tell the cook, hey, could you make me something? Then you're not paying for it. So
But you're there often to do roasts, aren't you?
Yeah. Then
you're
at least
popular
you get
roasts.
Fed. Yeah. And so, yeah, and the one where I was called the most disgusting was in The Aristocrats, which was like about 101 comedians. So that was an honor.
It was a whole the film was about all the different ways that you could tell the same incredibly dirty joke. And
yes.
I was surprised that it was dedicated to Johnny Carson, a man who didn't tell dirty jokes.
Yeah. I think Penn Jillette became friends with Carson, or so he claims.
And so that's why he dedicated it to Johnny.
Yeah.
Who was, by the way, one of the most brilliant interviewers I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that annoys me where he's made into a god, but he was a great interviewer.
Now, you have two children. Would you allow them to see that film, The Aristocrats?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that'll pop up of me on TV or on the computer where I got to go, okay, maybe we'll turn to something else here.
Someone tweeted, Affleck fires Gilbert Gottfried after discovering he's a comedian.
That was one of my favorite tweets that I got, was because it really was the case.
Now, there are comics who do that. You, Joan Rivers, Don Rickles, you. People, I would think, would expect you to tell those kind of jokes by now. Why do you think they're still surprised?
I kind of wonder in that case where I got fired if it wasn't a convenient outrage. Like, because they wound up firing me, getting loads of free publicity from it.
And then finding somebody who sounded like you.
Yeah, for less money. Thus bringing closure to a horrible tragedy.
Now, do you like doing stand-up? You're going to be doing stand-up this weekend at Caroline's on Broadway. Is it starting tonight?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Tonight is 7:30. But what is your stand-up act like? Is it you don't tell jokes, do you? Comics don't tell jokes anymore.
At the end of my set, like toward the end of my set, I start doing jokes from my Dirty Joke DVD that you can get on GilbertGottfried.com. And I still enjoy the idea of telling a joke, you know, but you don't hear them as much anymore.
Well, comics, in the past, that's what a lot of comics did. They would come on, they would just do this thing with a lot of connected jokes. And now it's more like you do some, of course, there's still supposedly punchlines.
Yeah.
But it's more like a theme.
Yeah.
It's almost like comics are doing sitcoms.
Oh, yes. And you know something there? That brings up another subject. I used to enjoy when they would call me up to do a guest spot on a sitcom. That was a fun thing to do. You showed up on the set and you were, Joe the mailman. And they'd say, action, you do it. Then you go off and drink a soda and go to the craft table. And I enjoy that much more than reality TV. But, I mean, recently I did Charlie Sheen's show, Anger Management, which is another case of Charlie Sheen is someone, you know, when his name comes up, you have to condemn him for everything that he does. But secretly, I think everyone's gone, wow, this guy's got all these broads and he's partying every night and they want to be him. He's basically like a modern day Rat Pack guy, you know, like it's like Dean Martin or Frank or any of those.
A little more extreme. Now, would you want to do a sitcom about your own life? Because that's something that a bunch of comics have done.
Oh, yeah. That
Raymond, probably the most successful one.
Oh, yeah. Or the one that everybody uses as an example. Like they say, hey, I'm working on this, and it's kind of a curb. And meaning like curb your enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. It's sort of got a curb feeling to it.
You will be, as I said, performing at Caroline's on Broadway tonight at 7:30, and then also this Friday and Saturday. Not tomorrow. You're taking the day off?
That's the way they set it up, that I'm working on Wednesday, today. Today, And then I guess Thursday's off because it's Thanksgiving.
And then Friday at 7:30 and Saturday at 7:30 and 10 p.m.
Well, now Friday I think it's two shows also, isn't it? Yeah,
okay.
I think so. I think both nights.
Will they be the
shows.
Same show?
It might be. I'm like, it's terrible when you've been in the business this long and you've got those bits you've been doing so long that you're thinking about your laundry.
While you're doing them.
Yeah.
That's why Lenny Bruce changed it every night. A bit could go for 3 minutes or 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, if you want more information, details about the appearances, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You can also, as I said, catch up on Gilbert Gottfried on his podcast, which is called Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. And you can see him at Caroline's on Broadway this weekend. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you.
PEN International is the only all-writers organization dedicated to protecting free expression and defending persecuted writers. To raise money for that cause, the PEN American Center is auctioning off 75 classic books retrospectively annotated by their authors. These first edition Second Thoughts create one-of-a-kind books and provide the bidders with the opportunity to engage in an intimate and private conversation with some of their favorite writers. Among the authors who have agreed to participate are Philip Roth, Don DeLillo, Patti Smith, Michael Cunningham, and my next guest, Robert A. Caro, who revisited The Power Broker, his classic book about Robert Moses. Mr. Caro is also the author of four so far volumes on Lyndon Johnson. He has won the National Book Critics Circle Award and virtually every other major literary award, including the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Biography twice. In 2010, he was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama. I'm almost intimidated to welcome Robert Caro back to our show.
Well, I'm intimidated to be on your show.
But it's really a treat to have you back, considering the amount of time you spent on the LBJ books. I didn't think that I would see you for another 10 years.
Well, it's better. It's nice to see you.
The last time you were here was in 2012 for The Passage of Power, which ended with Johnson's triumphant passage of civil rights legislation. You must be deeply involved in the final, although I'm never sure whether it's actually going to be the final one. Was it hard for you to pull yourself away to do this project?
Yes. When they asked me to write notes, to annotate, to go through The Power Broker and write down thoughts I had, I said I didn't want to do it. I said just the idea of going back into another book. And then I thought about how hard it was to do that book and being broke, and Moses had all these people who wouldn't, no one would talk to me. I said, I don't know that I want to revisit it. You know, but I did, and it was a great experience to remember these things.
It began actually with some articles you were writing at Newsday
on Robert Moses.
Well, it was about Suffolk County, wasn't
yes.
it?
Well, Moses wanted to build this bridge from Long Island over to Rye and Oyster Bay, and Newsday had me. I was a young reporter, look into it to see about it, and I discovered it was looked like it was the worst idea in the world, because the Long Island Expressway would have needed 12 more lanes, as I recall, just to handle the traffic from New England. And the bridge would have been so big, Leonard, that its piers would have actually obstructed the tidal flow in Long Island Sound and caused water pollution there. So I wrote this series of articles.
Suffolk the Sick Giant.
Yeah.
And what was Robert Moses' response?
Well, Robert Moses' response was to go to Albany. So the newspaper had sent me up there to make sure that people understood about the idea. And I talked to Governor Rockefeller and the Assembly Speaker and the President of the State Senate. Everyone seemed to know it was the worst idea in the world. So I wrote a story saying it was dead, came back to Newsday and was doing other things. I had a friend up in Albany then. And I suddenly get a call from him, and he says, Bob, you better come back up here. And I said, oh, no, I don't think that's necessary. I think I took care of it. And he says, you know, Robert Moses was up here yesterday. I think you ought to come back. And I'll never forget it, Leonard. I drove up to Albany and walked into the press gallery of the Assembly as they were passing an authorization bill for his bridge by something like 134-8. I don't remember.
He had that much clout.
Yes.
So did you, when you were researching that series, is that when you began to think about the power of elected and also appointed officials?
Not really. You know, when you're a reporter, you never really have a chance to think beyond your articles. You're always running from one thing to another. But I became a Nieman Fellow. That's like a journalist who gets a year at Harvard. And during that year, Ina wasn't with me because her mother was... My wife, Ina, wasn't with me because her mother was terribly sick. She died that year. And I don't like to go to social things alone without Ina. So I spent a lot of time in my office. They give you a little office up there thinking. And what I realized was all the stuff I've been writing about politics is basically baloney because it's all based on the underlying theory that we live in a democracy and power comes from being elected. But here was a guy who was never elected to anything, and he has more power than anyone who was.
And you realize there that what they were telling you about how highways get built wasn't exactly true?
Oh, yes.
At least in New York.
Yeah, that's right. Highways got built where Robert Moses wanted them built.
And that meant sometimes really curvy routes because he wanted to not to go here, but he wanted to go there. And if you unfortunately were in the way, you wound up losing that battle every time.
Every time.
Now, The Power Broker is over 1,000 pages long. You've annotated it. Where did most of your annotations fall?
Well, it throughout, you know, there's a chapter there where I hadn't thought about this chapter in years.
Have you gone back and looked at the book? I know you.
I had not opened the book. Possibly, it's a 40-year span, so you hate to say never. I think I never opened the book. I couldn't stand the thought. I mean, it was really hard to do that. We were broke all the time. You know, it came out okay.
Well, the New Yorker started publishing excerpts, and that saved you.
That changed everything, but that was after 7 years, you know. So when you look back at the 7 years, my wife, it was 7 years of being broke.
You sold your house.
Yes, we sold the house. But it was before the real estate boom, so we bought it for $45,000. We sold it for $70,000, so we cleared $25,000. That was enough to live on for a year.
And go to Paris.
No, we couldn't go to Paris until the New Yorker bought it.
So that was a rough time, but at the same time, you obviously felt a real commitment to doing this because as you were doing your research, you were discovering more and more things that nobody else had talked about?
Yes, it was like, I thought I knew as a young reporter, I won a couple of awards, really minor journalistic awards, but when you win anything when you're young, you think you know everything. I thought I was really explaining how power worked. And every time I thought about Robert Moses, the more I found out, I said, you know, we have no understanding of how power really works in cities in America. And I really felt it was important that somebody tell people about it, explain it to people.
You thought this was going to take you 9 months to do?
Yes.
Initially. You said that you went back to one chapter in particular.
Well, when I was annotating the book, one of the things I remembered was, you know, there's a chapter called 1 Mile about how he ran this road, the Cross Bronx Expressway, right through the East Tremont neighborhood. When he didn't have to, there was an alternate route available that required little demolition. And he demolished 54 six- and seven-story apartment houses. And, you know, in books at that time, you kept reading the sentence, the human cost of highways. But no one had ever written what the human cost was. And I said to Ina, you know, I really want to take... I said, I got an idea. He built 627 miles of parkways and expressway. I'm going to take 1 mile and show the human cost. But then I said, and we had been... This was at the bottom of the financial problems. And I said, but you know, it's going to take 6 months to do this. And Ina said, as she always does, go ahead. And when I reread the book, I mean, what I remembered was all, I've tried to find all the people, I tried to find people who had been relocated, thrown out by Moses. They were mostly elderly Jewish or German couples who had worked in the garment district. And the word that I kept hearing in these interviews was lonely. They were living up in apartments in Co-op City, or they were living with their kids, or they were living in a housing project, but their neighborhoods, their friends were gone. So the, I felt I have to spend the time to do this right.
And you didn't just rely on the interviews. You also felt it was important to research documentation of that event. So that doubled, I imagine, or more, the amount of time you spent on working on that chapter.
That was, well, you asked me what I remember. I mean, I'll tell you something I've forgotten for 7 years. I was going around to this East Tremont neighborhood, which the Cross Bronx Expressway had turned into this gigantic, horrible slum. And I would drive over there, and, you know, you'd go into the lobbies of these apartment houses. This was the 70s. The walls would have been broken open so that the drug people could take the copper pipes, you know, for to sell. And you were always, the everything smelled of urine, you know. You'd go to the different people's, you'd knock on the door. What I remember, you'd go up to an apartment and you'd hear the feet of children running around. And you'd knock on the door. And the moment you knocked, they would stop. Everyone would be silent. And if you kept knocking, sometimes they wouldn't open the door at all. But when they did, you had scenes that you and I would have a hard time. I remember one woman, she was an African-American woman. She was quite beautiful and young, and she had a number of children with her. No matter what question I asked her, she kept saying over and over again, I've got to get my kids out of here. I've got to get my kids out of here. So it was heartbreaking to me. And then I realized, you know, that I was spending this old, there was a group of elderly men who sat outside one of these apartment houses. And one of them said to me one day, he said, you know, you were here after dark last night. He said, don't be here after dark. And all of a sudden, I sort of got scared.
Now, this, you're talking about the destruction of what was a rather vibrant neighborhood before the road was built. Didn't Moses have notices nailed on the doors that looked official but had absolutely no... no force of law behind them?
Yes, that was one of his tactics. They were printed to look like official court notices, and they would say you have 30 days, you're in the path of this road, and you have 30 days to get out, then you have 15 days to get out. Imagine if you were a lower middle class family, you don't have much money, what these notices meant to you.
You profiled a woman who tried to stop him but didn't have any of the necessary social capital to do it.
Yes, or, you know, this wasn't an era. Her name was Lillian Adelstein. I've always been sorry that I didn't write more about her. She was a real hero to me.
My guest is Robert A. Caro, who has looked back 40 years later on his classic book, often cited as the best book ever about New York history. It's called The Power Broker. He has annotated it as part of a project of the Pan American Center, which is auctioning off 75 classic books retrospectively annotated by their authors. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Robert Caro talking about a project that I guess you weren't really looking forward to initially, looking back 40 years later at The Power Broker, no matter how important that book has been to your life because you're so involved in the LBJ series. But I suspect you did it partly because Penn International asked you to do it.
Yes, although, you know, I wanted Penn to do it. Writers' organizations always need money, and I felt this was a good idea. I also felt I wanted to look at some of the other writers and see what they said. But at first I said no, because I just couldn't bear to look back on those 7 years again.
Some listeners have been writing in apropos of the Bronx Highway. Michael on Twitter points out a passage about the construction of the Van Wyck, saying Moses had promised that traffic will flow freely. Should people trying to escape the city for Thanksgiving today blame Moses for any trouble that they'll encounter on that road?
Well, you know,
or the other roads?
Well, you know, the Van Wyck, when he built it, they said, you must put light rail, make provision for light rail here, because right now the land is relatively inexpensive. If you don't do it now, you'll always have trouble doing it. New York is one of the worst cities in the country as far as getting to the airport.
And that is because, actually, the idea that if you build more highways, you're going to ease traffic turns out not to be true.
Well, it's the opposite. Can I take? Let's talk about the Long Island Expressway because it's the best. It's the best example.
It should be called a parkway because you park there so often.
Oh, that's great! I hadn't heard that before. but when he built that, Suffolk County and the eastern whole third of Nassau County was still relatively unpopulated farmland, potato farm. Land was very inexpensive. He sets out to build this massive expressway the length of Long Island. And they say to him, you know, you're buying the right-of-way that you're buying is 200 feet. If you buy 40 feet more, that's enough right-of-way to put a light rail line down the center. If you do this now, people who want to use the expressway to drive will be able to do it. But people who don't want to come into the expressway by car will have the light rail line. And they said land is so cheap that every 10 miles or so you could have immense parking areas so people can drive to their homes and get on a train. And Moses said, I'll never do that. And they
said, didn't like public transportation.
No, he hated public transportation.
Why?
Well, that's you ask good questions. Part of it was actually strategic. He viewed public transportation as competition for the tolls. You know, the basis of his power was money, the tolls that he got from the Triborough and other bridges and the Queens Midtown Tunnel. He viewed, correctly or incorrectly, public transportation as a rival. But there's another reason. He said to me once,
when he finally agreed to talk to you, because for a long time he stonewalled and he asked the people who worked for him not to talk to you.
That's right. He asked everyone not to talk to him.
But some did anyway?
Well, not really.
I'm sorry to digress, but we'll come back.
Not really. You know, people have been trying to do a biography of Robert Moses for 40 years. And he had always said to them what I guess – he didn't say it to me. He had his PR guy, Edward V. O'Brien, say to me. He said, the commissioner will never talk to you. His family will never talk to you. His friends will never talk to you. And then he had this great phrase, Leonard. I forget the exact phrase. He said, and nobody, but what he meant was nobody who ever wants a contract from the state or city will talk to you. So for about 2 years, that was the situation. What I did was I drew a series of concentric circles. I put a dot in the middle that was Robert Moses. I said the first circle is his family, next circle out was his friends, then his associates, his politicians. But then in the outer circles are people who only encountered him once or twice in their life. He's not going to remember them. So I started with them, and I knew I was doing more and more interviews that they must be telling people at the next circle, you know, there's this young man. And finally, I think Moses realized that this biography was going to be done whether he wanted it or not. And for a short time, I had 7 interviews with him. Then as soon as I started asking hard questions, that was the end of it.
He wanted to control things. That's what he did. Yeah. You were told that you wouldn't be given any access to his papers, but you eventually got it by going to the outermost circle.
Well, the papers is a wonderful story. You knew Mary Nichols, who was connected with this.
She was my first boss here at WMIC.
Well, she was
Mary Parrott Nichols.
Mary Parrott Nichols, a wonderful person. I hardly knew her. You know, she was sort of a legend in journalism. I was a young reporter. We had both covered the World's Fair, and she told me later she had noticed my coverage. I couldn't get to see his papers. You know, no one had ever seen Robert Moses' papers. They were literally under, when you went to Randall's Island, they were in a corridor lined with file cabinets, and there was an armed guard at the entrance. One day she called me up and she said, I hear you're doing a biography of Robert Moses. And I suggested, and she said, I hear you can't get to see his papers. And I suggested, and she said, well, you know what he forgot about? He forgot about the carbon copies. And she knew where they were. They were stored in the 79th Street boat basin in a lower level that had been designed as a parking garage. And she got me a key. And Ina and I, for really, I think, several months, would go there every morning. You know, this was before Xerox. Mm-hmm. It was the copying machine was like a heavy machine. And Ina and I would carry this machine down, and I'd take notes, you know, and we'd copy the important documents.
Now, we digressed when we were talking about the Van Wyck.
Oh, the Long Island Expressway.
With the Long Island Expressway, yeah.
So Moses was buying 200 feet of right-of-way. They said, buy 240 and build light rail. He said, I'll never build light rail. They said, okay, then at least buy the 40 feet now. It's so inexpensive now, it's hardly a bump in your overall estimate. But the minute the expressway opens, at every exit, there's going to be development. The land is going to get too expensive. You're not going to be able to put light rail. Moses wanted to ensure that there would never be light rail on the Long Island Expressway. So what he did was not only did he not buy the 40 feet, but he engineered that road. You know, if you want light rail, you have to make heavier foundations. I used to know the right names for these, but I don't. He has light foundations there. So really, you're never going to have light rail there.
Now, people have said that he was an elitist, that he was a classist, that he was a racist, and that those were motivations for some of these kinds of decisions.
Well, yes. You know, if you look on the Southern State Parkway, the Meadowbrook Parkway, and the Wantagh Parkway, and the parkways that lead to Jones Beach, he opened them in the early 1930s. Poor people and poor people of color didn't have cars in large part then. So they would be able to get to the beach only by Jones Beach, only by public transportation. So he took care of the railroad. The Long Island Railroad wanted to build a spur to Jones Beach from Wantagh. He took care of that in the legislature. On the parkways, he knew they could only get there by buses. So he built the bridges, 178 bridges, too low for buses to get through.
And that way, some people say he saved Jones Beach and some other places. Is there a positive side to some of his decisions?
Not to those decisions. You know, when I was doing this book, I said, I wonder what the impact. He didn't want black people there. So I said, now it's 1970s. It's 40 years since he opened this beach. Let's see if the impact of that stayed. Ina and I stood at the underpasses from the parking lot. We each had a pair. And on each pair, we had had three columns, whites, blacks, and then we called them Hispanics. And I still remember the column of whites. You know, you do four marks and cross it for five. The whites would go down onto the next page. The Hispanics would be a little, hardly any blacks. You know, he believed that blacks didn't like cold water, so he would keep the swimming pools icy cold.
And he had the power to make those kinds of very limited decisions? I mean, you know, that's micromanaging.
Well, his power, and he had it for 44 years, was greater than any mayor, greater than any governor, greater than any mayor and governor combined.
Didn't he? And then he had, for example, he had little clauses put into agreements that turned out to give him a lot of power. Al Smith was assumed that he was the governor and he had the power. And it turned out that Robert Moses pulled one over on him.
Well, and LaGuardia, you know, there's a note from Moses to LaGuardia that I found in the LaGuardia papers. LaGuardia says, you're not in charge here. I'm in charge. This was of the Triborough Bridge Authority. And Moses writes on it in hand, Mayor, take a look at the contracts.
He also politicized things like buying insurance for the bridges. How did that work?
Well, you know, to us, Leonard, a bridge is a traffic machine. It's something to do with transportation. For Robert Moses, a bridge was also power. How do I mean that? There are insurance premiums on a bridge. This was before terrorism. A bridge was never going to fall down. So the insurance company that got the insurance on the structure was going to have a lot of money, and the brokers were making. Moses gave out the insurance premiums on the bridges in exact ratio to the number of votes these political leaders who were in the insurance business controlled in the legislature.
We once did a three-part series on Robert Moses on the anniversary of the consolidation of New York, when Brooklyn became part of the city. And it was the positive Robert Moses, the negative Robert Moses, and the legacy. We've only been talking about the negative so far. What are some of the positives?
Well, some of the positives, you know, you look at the Long Island Park system, whatever the other aspects are, he saved those beaches from development. We have, development was about to come over Jones Beach. In fact, Moses used to really, you know, make me really feel, he was a young man, and he said, you know, we were lost the first vote to get Jones Beach. I could see the development coming closer, and I thought, we've lost it. So, I mean, his early battles to create those parkways where the people on Long Island didn't want what they called the rabble from the city, they're heroic, noble examples of public, the civic responsibility.
And then he created a few parks that are just wonderful.
Yes.
On the West Side, for example.
Well, Riverside Park, you know, you say, what was, people don't even remember. They look at the park, it's like they thought it was always there. Before Robert Moses, what was there was open railroad tracks.
A number of people have written in to say, maybe we need somebody like Robert Moses. If we would have had a better Sandy recovery, we might have had a better recovery after 9/11. What do you think? Is that the equivalent of saying a dictator sometimes gets things done?
Well, it's approximately the you know, with Moses, you say, where was the city when Moses left power in 1974? You remember it. The city was not like New York today.
There's been a lot of controversy over the toll on the Verrazano. He promised that the tolls would be eliminated when the bridge paid for itself. And the tolls, if anything, are higher now than they have ever been.
Well, I don't actually know, to be fair to him, that he promised that. What he did was, before Robert Moses, people thought of public authorities as an entity. It sold bonds to pay for a bridge, like the Henry Hudson Bridge. It collected tolls to pay off the bonds. And when the bonds were paid off, it went out of existence. Moses said, no, if I can keep control of these. So he inserted in these legislation little clauses that said he could keep the bridges going forever.
Now, we start off by talking about the this project for Penn, first edition, Second Thoughts. When will your book be auctioned off?
Why, it's December 2nd.
Christie's. Very soon.
Yes.
And that's one copy only?
One. It's the only time with my writing. You know, I think that the first thing says, I didn't want to do this. Look back on 7 years of being broke, no one would talk to me.
Yeah, but you must have been proud once you looked at it again.
I've got to say, going back through that book was a great experience.
We have images of it on our show page at WMIC.org, and I'm hoping to see you soon for the next volume on Johnson.
Thanks, Leonard.
That's... You're not going to tell me when. Robert Caro, thank you so much for being on our show, and I hope the book sells for an awful lot of money to help Penn America.
Thanks, Leonard. It's always great to see you. Great questions.
Gary Trudeau has been satirizing American politics with his Pulitzer Prize-winning comic strip Doonesbury since 1970. More recently, he's applied his wit to a comedy series called Alpha House, which follows four Republican senators as they maneuver the political machinations of Washington, D.C., while they face the looming midterm elections and uncertain political futures. The show is set in real time with real-life politicians, journalists, and pundits. All 10 episodes of the second season are now streaming on Amazon Prime Instant Video, and I'm very pleased to welcome Gary Trudeau to our show. Hi.
Hi.
The main characters of the show, these four Republican senators, all live together in a townhouse in Washington. Isn't that based on a real situation?
It is a real situation that's about to come to an end. The premise of the show was inspired by four U.S. legislators who share a house on Capitol Hill. It's based on a house owned by Congressman George Miller, which he shares with Senator Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer, and it's sort of a rotating cast. And he's been doing it for years, since the late 70s. So what... You know, the basic premise is four very powerful senators arguing over cereal and laundry in the morning, and then they walk 10 minutes to work where they deal with important affairs of state.
But the senators you were talking about are Democrats. These are all Republicans. Was it important to make your main characters Republican senators?
Yes. I chose to make them Republicans purely for narrative reasons. I once did a show for HBO years ago with Robert Altman called Tanner, which was about an old-school Democrat, liberal Democrat running for president. And it was during the age of Reagan, and at that time it was the Democrats who were in the wilderness before Clinton led the party back to the center with his third way. But today that story is really about the Republicans. Story is always about conflict. And the Democratic Party is not nearly as conflicted at the moment. There isn't the same battle for the soul of the Democratic Party the way there is with the Republicans. So it's just an inherently dramatic struggle. And, you know, what I'm doing is watching these guys trim their sails so much they barely recognize themselves. And so it's just much more interesting than anything I could imagine with the Democrats.
Although you don't have Robert Altman as a collaborator in this case.
Alas, no.
Unlike other D.C.-based political dramas like House of Cards, Alpha House is set in present-day Capitol Hill with President Obama and key political figures. Was it important to use real people and events, something you've also done in Doonesbury?
Yes. I mean, it's just what I'm comfortable with the parallel universe and not the alternate universe that's favored by most political shows, which just feel a little phony to me. And it's just a way of working that I'm very comfortable with, and it allows us to fold in all kinds of current issues with the hope that, you know, some weeks down the road, people still will be thinking about them and discussing them.
And I assume also discussing who they think the characters are based on. Senator Andy Guzman, played by Mark Consuelos, behaves like a cross between Marco Rubio and Chris Christie.
Well, he started with the former and acquired some of the qualities of the latter as the stories came out of New Jersey. But you know, those are just starting points. Those are just ways of thinking about the character when you first initially introduce them. But you leave them in the dust pretty quickly. The parody itself is fairly limited and not all that interesting. You want to create a character that is, you know, his own category and his own person and has his own personality quirks and not be locked in by mimicking a real person.
And you seem to be giving us more of a sense of their personal lives in the second season and other kinds of things. The daughter of Senator Gil John makes a few appearances with the crew of her reality show, The Real Daughters of D.C.
Right.
Do you think...
Well,
go ahead.
In any first season, obviously you have to establish the principal characters. In our case, it was the four guys. But once you get into the sophomore season, if you've done your job, it's then possible to expand that world. And unfortunately, I am a little promiscuous in adding characters. The strip has something like 80 recurring characters. And in Alpha House, we're already up to 24. Now, normally in a sitcom, you have three principals and a wacky neighbor. I mean, that's what people usually expect. But the world that they're moving through is so rich and so interesting, and they encounter so many different kinds of people, and they all have their own, you know, satellites, staffers who are sort of swirling around them with their lives. They're all a different generation. That you don't want to miss any of that. So we pack as much as we can into 28 minutes.
Although you do have these four senators and a neighbor who's also a senator and a Democrat,
right.
Wanda Sykes.
Right.
Who drops by to check in on them.
I try to use her as some of our other guest stars, when available. And it presents an interesting writing challenge because, people like Wanda Sykes and Cynthia Nixon are very busy, and some of our young actors now are getting a lot of offers. So it's a challenge to keep them, connected to the stories. We have most half-hour shows have an A story and possibly a B story and then what are called runners, these smaller stories. We have four principal stories and a number of secondary stories and runners, all braided together. And the fun of the show, I think, is just experiencing that world in all its richness.
Although you had to write it at a certain point and then deal with the reality of politics. For example, three of the four senators are facing Democratic challengers in the midterms, and they all seem to be struggling with their political identities. But judging from what just happened during the midterm elections, would they, as Republicans, have had much to worry about?
Well, that's a good point, and we hope the results aren't too anticlimactic. There is a cliffhanger. There's one election that comes right down to the wire in Pennsylvania, and it's not resolved by the end of the second season.
That's Robert Betancourt.
Right. My hope is that my boss of bosses, Jeff Bezos, so wants to find out how that gets resolved that he'll be picking up the series.
He's facing opposition from former Governor Ed Rendell, and he has to confront the difficulties of being a black Republican.
Right, with virtually no constituent support from the black community in Pennsylvania. And this bothers him as much as you might imagine. He is the Clarence Thomas of the Senate. He, complete with all the contradictions, his belief in personal responsibility is always at war with a sense of victimhood. But he's a seasoned politician. He's good at what he does, and he's very motivated to stay where he is. So he does what he thinks he has to do to get a modicum of support from the community he was raised in.
We're talking with Gary Trudeau, whose political series Alpha House is currently streaming on Amazon Prime Instant Video. North Carolina Senator Gil John Biggs, who's played by John Goodman, who looks like he was born to play senators, is a retired University of North Carolina basketball coach, and he's devastated when one of his former students challenges him in the midterm elections. He's also distancing himself as much as he can from the Tea Party.
Right. He feels that just out of intellectual neglect and the various inertia problems he's always suffered from, that he's allowed himself to get pulled so far to the right that he doesn't recognize himself. And in the primary, that's less of an issue because his opponent is even further right than he is. But when it comes to trying to appeal to moderates in the general election, he feels if he's going to lose, he's got to lose as who he is and not who he's become.
But he reluctantly produces attack ads through a super PAC run by the evil Watt brothers, who meet with him via drones. And I'm assuming that the Watts were inspired by the Kochs.
The Kochs and Adelson and a few other folks who've become quite prominent in politics in the last two cycles because of the change in the campaign finance laws.
John Goodman received a Satellite Award for his performance on the show. Did you have him in mind when you created this character?
I didn't. I really hadn't really focused on the cast when I submitted the pilot to Amazon. He quite naturally emerged very quickly as our most desired candidate, and there was an enormous kick to the whole project when John agreed to do it after only 2 days. He looked at it he read it on a Monday and agreed to do it on a Wednesday, and it just, House of Cards had not come out then, and no one knew what the future of streaming television was. And I thought, what does this man know that I don't? Because I felt that streaming television at that time, I equated in my mind with low production values and kind of YouTube quality of storytelling. And Amazon said, no, the future is streaming TV, and we want to go head-to-head with HBO. We want to make shows of that quality. And they put up the resources to do that, and that included being able to hire someone like John Goodman. Since he joined, just as I'm sure it had the same impact as when Kevin Spacey joined House of Cards, it suddenly gave the whole community permission to jump in. And so we got a first-class cast and crew for the pilot before anybody'd seen anything on streaming TV.
But because you're responding to real-life events, the current political events like immigration reform, gay marriage, transgender military personnel, the NSA, Benghazi, was it difficult to stay current and keep up with the news when you were writing the shows months in advance?
Well, to some degree, there is a discussion with each issue as to just how fresh it will seem to an audience. It is a calculated guess. Now, we thought the attacks on Obamacare, Benghazi, were going to stay in the news, and sure enough, the Benghazi is with us once again, and Obamacare will be very shortly with the new Congress. So there are certain things that it doesn't take much imagination to imagine, to forecast that will remain in the news. But what's important for us, because we have audiences in other countries, is that the issues don't become so dense in their detail and so perishable that the show will be too difficult for a foreign audience to decode and thus enjoy. So far, we think we've been pretty successful with that you don't have to be deeply informed in order to be entertained by what happens to these guys.
Go ahead.
Well, just on the minutia of the issues that are in the news at any given moment.
Then you also, to appeal to people all over the world, you have cameos from people like Bill Murray, but also a lot of recognizable people, Matt Lauer, Rachel Maddow, David Axelrod, Grover Norquist, your wife Jane Pauley, among others. Elizabeth Warren made an appearance. Is it hard to get them to do this, or are they really excited about it?
Well, apparently not. I have to give most of the credit for that to John Alter, my co-executive producer. That he's the one with the deep Rolodex, and who's known all these folks as in his capacity as a senior editor at Newsweek for many, many years. And so he's the one who's reached out to them. But the more people that see the show, the easier it is to get people. What I learned from the Tanner experience years ago, where we also folded in real people to give it a kind of verisimilitude that we thought was important if we were going to have people believe that Jack Tanner was running in a national election. The lesson from that was don't give non-actors things that's not within their skill set to do. So mostly we had politicians talking on issues they were already, that already put them in a comfort zone. For instance, when Bruce Babbitt dropped out of the 88 election campaign, we put him on a stroll around the basin the tidal basin in Washington, talking about that experience and trying to impart the wisdom that he had acquired to Jack. So it was something that was right, that he was passionate about, and then he didn't have to worry about acting. Once you get give a politician a line, you get into trouble. I mean, a civilian can ruin a scene as an extra, and you don't want to break the reality of the show with people who can't handle the actual performance values. So there were only two exceptions to that we made in the second season of Alpha House. The first was with Elizabeth Warren, and the second was with Rachel Maddow. In Elizabeth Warren's scene, it's a standalone scene that's not critical to plot. We could lose it if we'd had to. But I just had this sense that she would bring her personal warmth and naturalness to to the scene. And John Goodman said later that she was the one calming him down before the scene. Now, with Rachel Maddow, it got even more interesting because she's not a friend of mine, but I write a scene in which, you know, it's very much about her personal life. And so I sent it to her and I said, you know, if any of this feels uncomfortable coming out of your mouth, you have to tell me because, you know, we don't expect you to act. We expect you to say lines that are completely consistent with who you are. And she changed one word, I think, and then she came in and nailed it. And all the professional actors were just stunned. And I mean, it's a short scene, but a very important one because it's at a very pivotal moment in the last episode.
Hey, Gary, we got to leave it here. Unfortunately, we can't get to your Mormon senator who's rumored to be gay, or the sex addict senator. But that's why people watch these shows. Gary Trudeau's show, Alpha House, is in its second season. You can see all 10 episodes on Amazon Prime Instant Video. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.